Hi, you are listening to the Conflict and Development in Africa podcast. This podcast is for policymakers, governments, researchers, students, businesses, and anyone that is interested in conflict and development issues in Africa. On this podcast, we hear from experts from across Africa and the world. Your host, Dr. Michael Wangpa, will ask the questions you would want answers to. Michael Wangpa has an extensive experience spanning over a decade studying, researching, writing, and consulting on conflict and development issues in Africa.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Conflict and Development in Africa podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Michael Wangpa. Today, we're going to be discussing the anti-France revolt of Francophone countries cutting ties with France. I'm joined by a very special guest, Professor Tony Chaffa, Emeritus Professor of African and French Studies at the University of Portsmouth. He's also Senior Associate Fellow at Royal United Services Institute, among other positions. Tony, I'm very delighted to have you join me today, and I look forward to a wonderful conversation.
Thank you for inviting me. Pleased to be
brilliant.
Here.
Yeah, brilliant. So we've seen in recent years, we've seen what we can classify as a revolt in former French colonies in Africa, where several countries are severing or have severe ties with France. The latest being, I think, Ivory Coast. So I wanted to begin with what are the factors or what are the factors behind this revolution or revolt, if you want to call it that way?
I suppose in order to understand the background to it, you really have to go back to political independence in 1958-1960, which is when the former colonies of France in sub-Saharan Africa all gained their independence. And unlike the British case, which when it decolonized in Africa, it largely, once it had decolonized, left. For France, decolonization was a strategy to remain. And to put that into context, General de Gaulle came back to power in 1958. And by 1958, the anti-colonial tide, if you like, was running very fast. Mm-hmm. And France had been involved in a war of decolonization in Indochina from 47 to 54. And then as soon as that finished, there was a new war of decolonization in Algeria, which wouldn't, of course, finish until 1962. So the calculation really that de Gaulle and many of the, not all, but many of the governing elites of France at the time made the calculation that if France was to maintain influence in sub-Saharan Africa and with its Francophone, what's now called frequently Francophone Africa, with its former colonies, then it would have to ride the anti-colonial horse. It would have to go with the flow. The tide was now running that the former colonies wanted. De Gaulle never called it independence. It was international sovereignty. Hmm. And he decided that the way in which France would maintain influence in that part of the world was to, as some commentators have put it, to decolonize so as better to remain. And the idea then was to hand over power as far as possible to African leaders who were broadly favorable to France. This transfer of power would take place peacefully, and that then France would be able to put in place cooperation agreements with its former colonies. And these cooperation agreements covered all sorts of things, from notably defence, military cooperation, cultural cooperation, which was very important in terms of maintaining the French language, the position of the French language in these countries. And also, of course, economic cooperation, because, again, a particularity of France, of French decolonization was that the former colonies in sub-Saharan Africa didn't gain monetary independence when they became independent, because they retained the CFA franc, and all remained part of, or not all, but the great majority of them remained part of the franc, of the franc zone. And in addition to that, France continued to ensure that a great deal of its overseas development aid post-independence went to its former colonies in Africa. So there were all these kinds of levers that France put in place, or all these kinds of mechanisms, if you like, that France put in place to maintain its influence in that part of the world. And there has always been a kind of undercurrent of, you could call, if you like, anti-French resentment since the 1960s, 1970s. The governing elites have often been seen as close to France, and often indeed been seen as too close to France, and unwilling to diversify their foreign relations, but beyond France. But there's always been this kind of discourse, if you like, criticizing France for its neo-colonialism, that it never properly decolonized. And you've seen bubbling up from time to time demands for what's often called a second decolonization. And so I think that historical context is important, because obviously I'm as a historian, at one level I sort of look back at this and I think, well, that kind of resentment against France has been there for years. It's been bubbling along under the surface, if you like. And I think what's happened in the last perhaps 10 or 15 years is that resentment that was always there to some extent, at the same time accompanied by a kind of attachment to France and to the French model and to the French language and French culture and so on. So it was a kind of almost a sort of schizophrenic thing in a way. But my point is that kind of resentment of France's what was characterized as neo-colonial interference, you know, whether it was military, whether it was political, whether it was economic, etc., has been there for a long time. What I think's interesting is, why has it really come to the surface in the last 10 or 15 years? What's triggered that? And why is it now? Is it manifesting itself as a rejection, not necessarily of the French, but of France of France as a state which is seen as still aspiring to play a key role in African and particularly African affairs in its former colonies, and there's all sorts of reasons why people have various feelings of resentment towards France, you know, young people particularly, the whole visa issue, the difficulty of actually getting to France, the ongoing economic crisis, the lack of employment opportunities, the you know, what happened around COVID and so on. So there was all these kinds of things that were that kind of fed into a sort of general sort of resentment. And I think that that's kind of really come to the surface recently. And, you know, as you go around, say, Dakar in Senegal, which has traditionally been one of the most, you know, closest to France, you know, there's on walls and on flyovers and so on, you know, there's these slogans, "France dégage," France proud. And I think that, you know, that there's a sense in which France has become a scapegoat almost for all the things that Africans and particularly young Africans feel is wrong with their country. It's all blamed on France. Some of it rightly so, but some of it, you know, has to be laid at the door of, you know, African leaders over the years as well. But the point is that it's there's been a number of things which we can talk about in a minute if you like. There's been a number of things which I think have driven this kind of resentment to the top of the agenda. And something that was there over many years, sort of bubbling along under the surface, has very much come to the surface.
Very interesting. This is a very useful historical context to the issue. But you've mentioned very important things. So in our last episode, I had with another French professor, you know, a very good friend. I don't know if you know him, Marc Antoine. We were talking about France's varied relationship with each Francophone countries. So you mentioned the special relationship with Senegal, with Dakar, but we also look at Chad as well. So where in Chad, and you mentioned Algeria. So why the decolonial or anti-colonial character in Algeria was one that would fit into Frantz Fanon's, I think it was Frantz Fanon that was saying, you know, the kind of independence that Africa had is one that is flag flying, one that has to be, one that has to do with fighting. And I think Algeria would be an exception, one where there was some sort of that kind of toil and blood kind of like fight against the French. So I guess the question is, within all these Francophone countries, former French countries, do you see varied response or the anti-France revolt in these countries? Is it molded against their historical relationship with France, or is it the same across board?
Well, a bit of both. I mean, obviously they all share the colonial past. They were all French. They were all French colonies. Although it's worth mentioning that since the late 1970s, France has also kind of subsumed into its kind of précaré, as they call it, its privileged sphere of influence, the former Belgian colonies of Rwanda, Burundi, and the Democratic Republic of Congo, and certainly up until the genocide of 1994. I mean, France was probably more so than Belgium. France was the main player, and it was certainly the main backer of the Habyarimana regime from 1990 to 1994, before the genocide. So. But France had developed this sort of special relationship out of its colonial, out of that colonial past. But it manifests itself very differently in different countries. I mean, Guinea, for example, which said no to De Gaulle in 1958 and no to the French community, and then, you know, shocked De Gaulle by taking immediate independence, which he hadn't expected any of them to do. And other countries like Mali, for example, was never really part of this French privileged sort of sphere of influence. I mean, it initially left the franc zone. It had to come back in 1968 after an economic crisis. It refused to have military bases on Malian territory. And that's one of the reasons, I mean, that was one of the reasons why there was this kind of development of a strong kind of anti-French movement in Mali in the sort of late noughties, beginning of the 2020s. You know, people were saying, well, our first president refused to have French troops on Malian territory and a French military base on Malian territory. But now we've had one for the last 10 years, you know, since 2013, we've had French troops based here. So you have to differentiate. I mean, the nature of the relationship between France and Senegal is very different from the one between France and Chad. Is very different again between the from the one between, say, France and Gabon or France and Côte d'Ivoire, for example. So I would say what's happened is while there is a kind of shared history, you actually, in order to understand the dynamics of the France-Africa relationship, you in a sense have to sort of look at the bilateral relations between particular countries and how their relations, how those bilateral relations developed. And you'll find different trajectories in Senegal from what you will in Côte d'Ivoire, and in Côte d'Ivoire from what you will, for example, in Niger or Burkina Faso. What France has increasingly done, I would say, particularly since the end of the Cold War, is developed increasingly differentiated bilateral relations. But the, you know, underpinning it was always this idea that this was, you know, if Central America was the US's backyard, then sub-Saharan Africa was France's backyard, and it was the kind of key player in that part of the, it sought to be the key player in that part of the world.
I wanted to look at them more like a historical kind of, like, again, look at the British approach to colonialism with the indirect rule, and look at France's assimilation policies and how that carried on even beyond the sovereignty that this, even though we know it's kind of like forced sovereignty, the sovereignty that they gained. Why did France carry on that policy? What is the motivation compared to the Anglophone kind of like experience?
I think the first way in which I would answer that question is that a lot is made of the difference in the colonial approach to governance, if you like, between the French and the British. French is supposed to be direct rule and assimilation, and Britain is supposed to be indirect rule and keeping much more of a sort of distance, if you like. And that's certainly true at some levels, and it's certainly true in terms of the discourse, if you like, colonial discourse. But if you actually look at how colonial rule operated in the French colonies and the British colonies, there were really important similarities. Both countries were trying to do colonialism on the cheap. Both countries needed local intermediaries through whom they could rule, because there were never enough Brits in the British colonies or French in the French colonies to, you know, they weren't settler colonies. So you needed intermediaries, collaborators who could make the system work and keep the costs down. And so at one level, whatever the discourse, the practicality of colonial rule was that they found themselves doing despite protestations often to the contrary, they found themselves being forced to do similar things because they were similarly strapped for resources and similarly lacked, you know, British and French personnel to run the colonial, you know, the colonial government and the colonial administration. But where it's where I think the assimilation really kind of comes into play and is important is, I think first of all, you need to look at what happened at the end of the Second World War. Hmm. What France did as part of trying to show that it was progressive and wanted, but at the same time to affirm the link between France and its colonies. Hmm. One of the things it did was to put in place a new republic, the Fourth Republic, where all the colonies elected representatives to the French Parliament, to the French National Assembly in Paris. So there was no equivalent on the British side. There was never the Honourable Member for Lagos sitting in the British Parliament in Westminster. Whereas in the French case, that was exactly what happened. You had people like Senghor, the first president of Senegal, Houphouët Boigny, the first president of Côte d'Ivoire, sitting in the French Parliament, becoming members or aligning themselves with French political parties. Some of them even on occasion became ministers in French governments because of the fractured nature of the National Assembly during the late 40s and 50s. Mm-hmm. So there was a kind of socialization process that meant that the leaders of the newly independent African Francophone African countries were very much part of the French political system in a way that wasn't the case with Britain. And if you add into that things like the cultural cooperation, I mean, the policy of sending large numbers of lecturers and teachers, higher education and secondary education in particular, as part of a sort of policy of what was called cooperation. So which maintained particularly the links between France and Francophone elites in these countries, which were a small part of the population. You know, you're talking about 5, 10, maximum 15% of the population. It was that kind of assimilation that I think underpinned this this kind of close relationship. And then if you add into that the fact that the currencies were attached to the French franc at a fixed rate of exchange, that France was the guarantor of the currencies of these countries, you can see how there is a... there are a series of kind of pillars, if you like, of the France-Africa relationship that ensure that there is a significant elite in these former French colonies, which have a strong attachment to France and a strong interest in maintaining that attachment to France. And who saw, for at least for a number of years, who saw the French military presence as a kind of security guarantee. So that's the way in which I would look at it. I wouldn't look at it quite so much in terms of direct versus indirect rule or assimilation versus association or whatever, but more around the way in which, if you like, the late colonial state developed in these colonies.
Yeah, I agree with you 100%. I agree with you 100%. I think when we can understand why France got the bigger end of the stick and why maybe the Americans felt comfortable in Niger when France was initially booted out. But I'll come back to that question. The question I want to talk to is, you've mentioned something in our last two episodes. We look at the concept of reparation. So we had one guest from the American side, and we had the last one was the commission of South African Human Rights Commission talking about reparation in the continent. One of the things he's mentioned, two things actually. He talked about after the colonial leaders left, the elites that took over, they moved into the structures, the houses that the colonial government had left. So what he's saying, which ties into what you're saying, is they became the new masters. They modeled, there was no distinction. They carried on, more. And what I've said in my last book that I wrote, I was saying that the new African leaders perfected, they inherited this political structure of oppression, and then they've gone to perfect it. And now you're talking about the friends of and the elites. So I guess the question is, do you agree that because my opinion is that the problem in Africa is the problem of elitism. The elites have been co-opted into this system of oppression. And what we're seeing is a different generation of youth that are far removed from, in terms of like number of years, from the colonial discourse or the narrative. And our challenges, so because we can see in different places in Zimbabwe, in Mozambique, where these anti-colonial parties in Botswana are beginning to crumble. So is that what is happening with this new revolt? Are we seeing a new youth that are challenging these elites that are attached to this colonial government in France in this case?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think there's a change of generations. I mean, the majority of these countries, as you know, the populations are very young.
Hmm.
Colonialism, they have no direct experience of, unless they've gone on to higher study, they probably haven't learnt much about colonialism at school. They may have got grandparents who talk about it, but for them, it's not part of their experience.
Mm-hmm.
Their experience is lack of jobs. Their experience is cost of living.
Mm-hmm.
Their experience is wanting to make a new future for themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And in that context, France has been seen as really on the side of the elites, of the political, economic elites.
Mm-hmm.
And so that has fueled a kind of anti-French feeling. But it's not related to any kind of experience of or memory of colonialism, because they don't have it.
Mm-hmm.
It's mm-hmm. to do with, contemporary realities of their lives and what they see as a France that is an obstacle to those to that better future. Now, of course, France isn't the only obstacle.
Yeah.
There are all sorts of other obstacles as well. But that's the context, I think, in which it's taken place. I don't know if that answers your question, but that does
answer. But again, that also leaves room for other actors, other players that are either parading themselves or have risen as alternative to France. Could talk about Russia, we could talk about the military, maybe in Burkina Faso, Mali and Niger. We could talk about Turkey and other middle powers. How do you see all of these dynamics? Are they credible alternatives or do they come?
Well, I think first of all, what I would say is that, of course, Russia was the first one that you mentioned, and Russia has been waging an information war, should we call it, on social media, and amplifying voices that are critical of France and France's role and critical of it as a neo-colonial power and so on and so forth. And that whole discourse, and this is what's so different, I think, from, say, 15 or 20 years ago, that whole discourse, the anti-French, the French are oppressing us, et cetera, that whole discourse is amplified 100 times over, if not 1,000 times over, by social media. And, you know, there's been plenty of work done to show how Russian disinformation systems and Russian social media sites have kind of fed into and promoted this kind of this anti-French this anti-French discourse. So so I think that and that's going back to your question about Mali, Niger, and Burkina. That's something that the juntas, the military juntas in these countries, have very much kind of fed into and also fed off in terms of their own discourse. They, you know, there is that, as I was talking about earlier, this sort of bubbling resentment against France that's been there for a long time, but now it's being amplified and made public because of the role of social media in a way that it never was before. My own view is that, I mean, there's been a lot of concentration on Wagner's military role in Africa, but I actually think that, you know, that's only one of its levers. I think the much more important lever is cyber warfare, is disinformation, and Wagner has really been a major player. Along with other Russian actors, in terms of amplifying this anti-French and also anti-Western discourse. You know, there's this, the idea that Russia is not a colonial power, that, you know, we're an alternative to these colonial stroke neo-colonial powers who are continuing to oppress you. And that and that strikes a chord with many young people who are very well connected into social media, but very kind of lacking in economic and social prospects because of the lack of jobs in their countries.
Yeah, you mentioned something about when you were talking about the factors that could have sparked this. You mentioned COVID. You mentioned the issues that young people would have getting a visa and all of that. If we look at, I think Emmanuel Macron have been making some statements in recent times. I don't think those statements have been helping relations or, you know, things moving forward. How do you see?
Absolutely right.
How do you see the French? And again, like you rightly mentioned, it's also extended to an anti-Western narrative. And like when I talk, I say the West can retreat from the Sahel, for instance, or retreat from Africa. It's because in terms of the insecurity, the international scale of the insecurity, all hands has to be on deck. But how do you see France? What could France have done better? And I will extend that to also maybe the West. What could they have done better? Or how could they repair their relations?
Well, I mean, coming back to Macron, I completely agree with you. He's actually made a bad situation worse. I mean, there's an old saying in English that if you're in a hole, stop digging. And he's carried on digging by some of the comments that he's made. And that has undoubtedly stirred up further resentment against France. I mean, if you go back to 2020, when France was the Operation Barkhane, in the G5 countries, Mali, Mauritania, Niger, Burkina, and Chad, there were growing anti-French demonstrations in the capitals of these countries. And then France, I think it was about 13 or 14 French soldiers were killed because two French helicopters of Operation Barkhane crashed. And there was that provoked further celebrations from many in there. Many young people, particularly in these countries, and there were also attempts to blockade, French arms convoys, trying to get arms to the French troops and so on. And Macron then summoned African leaders to Pau in the southwest of France to a. To a conference in which he made it clear that he wanted them to reaffirm their wholehearted support for French military operations in the region. Now, of course, that put lots of people's backs up. I mean, it was seen as condescending. It was seen as it was just seen as lacking in respect. To African leaders. And then most recently he's made this comment about how France left, and well actually it was our decision to leave. And by the way, you should say thank you. Somebody said to me, well, what would the best thing that Macron could do at the moment? I said, well, keep his head down. It's like nothing. I mean, the worst thing he can do is some of his interventions are really unhelpful in terms of if France wants to maintain a presence in that part of the world. And even, I mean, recently he invited President Tinubu of Nigeria in December on a state visit. And, it makes sense from France's point of view. They want to improve their relations and consolidate their relations with Anglophone Africa, and particularly with the economic big hitters, if you like Nigeria, South Africa, and Kenya. And, of course, the next Franco-African summit for the first time ever will not be in France or Francophone Africa. It'll be in Nairobi. But, of course, that's now on social media. Being portrayed as France has been kicked out of our countries, now it's trying to make sure that it can stay in Africa by getting closer to Nigeria and giving him a state visit and so on and so forth. So even that has become a sort of bone of contention and a kind of further proof of French, bad faith and interference and so on. If Macron was going to invite Tinubu to Paris, the best thing he could have done was to do it quietly, not have a state visit. And, so now across all the social media in places like Mali and Burkina Faso and Niger and so on, you've got these pictures of Tinubu being, all the sort of apparatus of the French state and the motorcades and the motorbike outriders and so on and so forth. And say, well, our presidents never had this treatment. So, these things, they're just insensitive, and they just make matters worse. If France does want to maintain some sort of presence and influence in that part of the world, this is not the way to go about it.
I used to, there's something I've been, I remember one of the, there's a conference I think it was, that was organized in the department in Portsmouth in 2018. That's when I began looking at the strategic interests. And I think Melissa and I did a panel in Bradford around that time. And yeah. I was looking at, from my own perspective, also including the broader West, the wider West, it's no one is intervening with our interests. There is a strategic interest. So France definitely has a strategic interest in this country.
Yes.
Yeah. The people have said, so my thing is always looking at how to balance that strategic interest with the interests of the people. When I say the people, not the elite. So looking at that and looking at how France is cutting like Nigeria, and how people say, oh, France wants to have a military base in Nigeria, or France wants some resources in Nigeria. And then you tie that into why is France always supporting also the perception of the Tinubu government as one that is maybe corruption, or one where the mandate is one that is not, you know, publicly accepted. So for looking at all of that and looking at how they can also see, create that anti-Western, anti-French sentiment about supporting elites that are corrupt, for that impoverishing the people. So how do we go beyond all of that? Again, I was looking at Kenya, for instance, as well, and looking at the level of human rights violation, and how, you know, people that are in Tanzania, for instance, there's an activist that was kidnapping in Kenya, and all of that going on. So I guess the question is, tying it down to issue of democracy and looking at the West as the promoter of democracy, and how that also creates this in Africa, people look at it as, no, this is an irony. You can't be on one hand saying you're the bastion of democracy, and then you're supporting corrupt leaders or further impoverishing. But how can we balance the strategic interest with doing things right? Because definitely the strategic, even though the alternative has strategic interest, Russia definitely has its own strategic interest. So it's not, so how do we balance it? How does the West in general now balance that strategic interest? But it's with doing the right thing, right intervention in these places.
Yeah. Yes, I mean that is, I think, a very good question. And it's not one to which there's an easy answer, because of the history of relationships between African countries and the West, and their former colonial masters, but also the United States is seen as part of that kind of Western dominated system, if you like. So in terms of how you change that, I think the first thing to do, if you're going to change it, is you have to think about establishing new partnerships which are genuinely equal partnerships. Because, African countries have their own interests. African leaders have their own interests. And, those need to be taken account of and respected, and it's very difficult for the West to sort of, coming back to your point earlier about to claim that it's the champion of democracy, when it seems to have a sort of it seems to champion democracy on a sort of variable geometry. It's very keen on promoting democracy in Mali, for example, but it's never seemed that keen on promoting democracy in Chad, for example.
Chad, yeah.
There's been long history of by African political leaders of abuses of human rights and so on and so forth, and Africans have suffered from those abuses of human rights over many, many years. And, you know, it wasn't something that the West intervened to do something about, to restore democracy. But lo and behold, when Russia invades Ukraine, suddenly everything can be done to challenge Russia, which is trying to snuff out a democracy, which is creating insecurity and so on. And it's seen by many Africans quite simply as double standards. And Western countries need to stop having these double standards if they're going to be able to make progress in terms of establishing, you know, real equal partnerships of mutual respect with the countries that they want to establish relationships with.
I agree with you. Let me come to the last question and ask and say, what is your prediction? Do you think the African friend from our colonies will be able to this is the second decolonization stuff. Do you think this is going to be a permanent? Are they going to be able to extricate themselves from French, the hold of French? Are they going to finally be able to have that freedom, the true independence? With this, is this a smoke screen? Is this going to pan out? Are they going to be able to achieve this? Because there seems to be a lot of optimism, especially for the juntas in Traore in Burkina, seems to offer that optimism to many people in the local. So how do you see this panning out?
Yeah. I mean, certainly one thing that African countries share is that they want to diversify their foreign relations, and particularly where they've had close relationships with the former colonial power, they want to diversify those relationships beyond the colonial powers, which of course makes perfect sense. From an African point of view, you don't want to have all your eggs in one basket. You want to have a diversity of economic, political, military relations. Mm-hmm. So that makes perfect sense. I suppose my worry, I suppose I've got two worries. I suppose my worry is that in rejecting Western countries, there is a danger of some African countries jumping out of the frying pan and into the fire, where the fire is either Russia or China. And ending up with all or most of their baskets in a Russian or a Chinese basket rather than a Western one. And I think the only way that African leaders can prevent that happening, because I think potentially African leaders have a huge amount of power in the current situation. You know, given that Africa has so many of the resources that the green transition and the new industrial revolution will need. But I think as things stand, my fear is that they're going to miss that opportunity because they're so fragmented. The needs to be that the old Nkrumah's idea of the United States of Africa, the old Pan-Africanist ideal, okay, well, maybe that was unrealistic, but there needs to be, Africa needs to start working more as a united entity. And it needs continental leaders who can ensure that the opportunities that are there can be grasped, because I don't think that individual countries like Burkina or like Niger, or even Niger, Mali, and Burkina together, three small, relatively poor countries would have the leverage. But if the African Union or if African regional organizations could actually come together and provide leadership, I think there are real opportunities there. But as I say, my fear is because of this fragmentation of the African political landscape, that they won't make the most of the leverage that potentially they have in order to really shape a new Africa and a new set of geopolitical relationships with the wider world.
Professor Otori Chafa, I'm indeed very grateful. And I do agree with you there that everyone agrees Africa at this point has a leverage. Whether they understand the leverage they have or whether they know how to utilize the leverage is one that we're going to be looking at for in the next couple of years. But yes, thank you very much for honoring my invitation. I really enjoyed our conversation, and thank you very, very much. I really do appreciate
it. It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
Yeah. Take care. Bye.
Bye.
Thank you for tuning in to this week's episode with our Professor Tony Chafa. I hope you've enjoyed this episode as much as I did. I want to encourage you to subscribe if you haven't already, share and like this video. And I'll see you next week. Until then, stay blessed.